From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call. Stay with Dr. Barry Dworkin for the next 2 hours, and we guarantee you'll go away learning at least one new thing to keep you on the road to better health. Here's your host, Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the November 25th, 2007 edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. I'm broadcasting live on 1070 CFAX in Victoria, 1290 CFRW in Winnipeg, 1050 Chum in Toronto, AM 800 CKLW in Windsor, and from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And coming up on the show, when the next flu pandemic hits, and it will be available to provide healthcare services? That's a question that was asked in a survey and will be commented upon by Dr. Allison McGeer, who's Director of Infection Control at Mount Sinai Hospital. And some of the responses, very interesting from the health professionals regarding their confidence in how the emergency system and services have been set up to deal with flu pandemics. As well, many people who listen to Sunday House Call have relatives, loved ones, or friends who may have had a stroke, be suffering from a condition called muscle spasticity, difficulty moving their arms because the muscles are contracting. And we'll be speaking to Dr. Lilith Satkunam, who's a physiatrist and founder and director of the Spasticity Program for Adults at the University of Alberta, providing you with some information about the newer treatments for spasticity and as well where you can get a hold of their booklet that's available that'll give you information regarding stroke in general and dealing with spasticity in particular. And as well, we're going to start a new recurring interview format with Mark Keeley. Mark Keeley, we'll get into the details about who he is, but he was CEO of the Ontario Pharmacists Association. He's been a hospital administrator, advisor to former Prime Minister and Premier of Ontario from 1984 to 1991. Lots of information regarding policy, outspoken opinions on drug supply, drug program reforms, integration among providers, healthcare providers. Just a good background of some of the stuff that we don't hear of and bringing it to light for you to consider given all the changes and all the proposed changes that are occurring in our healthcare system. That, plus your calls in our second hour at 1-800-580-2372. 1-800-580-2372, starting in our second hour. When the next flu pandemic hits, who will be available to provide healthcare services? A national survey was conducted recently that assessed the behaviors and attitudes of healthcare workers in the event of a flu pandemic. The results, in part, reflect the level of confidence healthcare workers and professionals have for infection control measures and protection in their work environment. And joining us today to discuss this research, Dr. Allison McGeer, Director of Infection Control at Mount Sinai Hospital, Professor in the Departments of Laboratory Medicine and Pathobiology and Public Health Sciences at the University of Toronto, and she's also Principal Investigator of the Toronto Invasive Bacterial Diseases Network and the Ontario Group A Streptococcal Study, two collaborative surveillance networks studying the epidemiology of severe community-acquired infections. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you trace the epidemiology of the flu over the past century? How many pandemics have we had?
Well, we've had three so far this century, but that's in a new century.
Right.
Now. So in the last century, we had three, and we've been able to track influenza pandemics for about three centuries now, and for the time we've been able to follow it, that's about the average. Pandemics come, the shortest interval has been 8 years, the longest interval in the last 300 has been 45. So we expect about three pandemics a century.
And the last one that we had was how long ago?
The last one we had was in 1968. It was really only a half a pandemic because the new strain was, in fact, somewhat related to the old strain. It was a very mild pandemic. People in healthcare, particularly in intensive care units, noticed it, but it was a very mild pandemic. The counter to that, of course, is the 1918-19 mm-hmm. pandemic, which is the most severe pandemic. So that does give, and the 57-58 pandemic, which was the other one, was sort of halfway in between. So some pandemics are pretty mild, and some of them are very severe.
What are the conditions that lead to the development of a pandemic?
Well, it's pretty simple, actually. Human influenza viruses only infect humans, and when you get them, you get sick, and then you get rid of them. So there's no carrier state that allows influenza viruses to survive in people who aren't sick. and they can't infect other beings. So if you think about how they have to survive, they have to keep infecting people. And they do that in one of two. Once you've been infected once, you can't get infected again.
Mm-hmm.
So influenza viruses need to keep changing to survive. And we get seasonal influenza, the annual stuff you get every year, by influenza viruses changing one small piece at a time. That's what we think of as Darwinian evolution, right? Under the pressure of people getting immune, they change a little bit at a time. And that's, of course, why you have to get a new flu shot every year, because every year it's a bit different. But they're quite closely related, and so people over their lifetime accumulate quite a lot of immunity in general. Pandemic viruses it's a different way of creating new viruses. And the way it happens is that a human virus and a virus from another species, most often we think ducks and other waterfowl, because that's where most influenza viruses are, combine to create a new human influenza virus. And that creates a pandemic because now, instead of a new virus with lots of the world having seen something related before and being partially immune, now you've got a brand new virus that none of us have seen, and everybody gets sick. And it's from the influenza virus's perspective, it's a way of maintaining themselves. But they actually don't see... We think of pandemics as very different from usual influenza. But from a viral perspective, it's exactly the same. It's a new virus, and it does what all influenza viruses do, which is spread around the world in a matter of months. And in fact, about in the first year, usually about a third, sometimes a little more, of the world's population.
And what were some of the issues, when we turn to the survey, what were some of the issues that led you to conduct this particular survey?
Well, this survey was conducted by actually one of the companies that makes drugs against influenza. What they were interested in doing in this survey was asking what healthcare workers thought about coming to work during the pandemic and what the conditions were that would allow them to come to work or not. This, of course, is a major issue for all of us. We know when the pandemic comes that it's going to be frightful for healthcare workers to go to work because people are going to be worried about getting sick themselves. But we also know that because, of course, more people are going to get sick in that short period of time when the pandemic is at its peak, that we're going to need healthcare workers to come to work. So the issues of what obligations healthcare workers have to work, the issues of what obligations the government or hospitals or other employers of healthcare workers have to their employees is an equally important question, and the issues of how we make healthcare settings as safe as possible. In a pandemic, nowhere is safe. You know, one of our biggest problem with influenza is, in fact, that we can't control it. You know, with SARS, we were really lucky that the epidemiology of SARS was such that we could stop it. With influenza, we're not talking about stopping it. We're talking about trying to minimize how many people get seriously ill and how many people die from it. So in that setting, we can't say to people, you're going to be safe. We can only say to people, we're trying to make things as safe as possible. And that discussion about what as safe as possible means and how healthcare workers see it is, of course, a really important one. We're going to need all of our healthcare workers working during the pandemic to save lives. But at the same time, we need to figure out how to adequately protect them so that they can do that.
Groups were involved in the survey.
Well, the people who were asked these questions were all different kinds of healthcare workers through the system. So people who work in hospitals, people who work in nursing homes, people who work for emergency medical services, anybody who provides professional healthcare.
And were there specific questions asked of them or scenarios given for them to get to gauge their level of confidence in showing up for work?
They were asked a series of questions about whether they were planning to come to work and if they were planning, what things might make them not come to work or come to work during the pandemic, what things might make them more comfortable with working. It was really designed to find out what what people are thinking now about whether they're going to work during a pandemic and what we could do to make mm-hmm. them more comfortable with being at work.
Were there any results that sort of stood out to that contribute to your presentation that there are legitimate concerns that people have about showing up for work? Were there specific responses that said, you know, we really don't want to come to work because of X?
Well, I think the probably the most important finding from the perspective of keeping on with the planning and where we need to go is that a very large fraction, maybe not surprising, but it's important to know that a large fraction of healthcare workers are sufficiently worried about it that they're thinking they may not come to work. Of course, you can turn that around and say it's actually probably the most surprising thing to me is that healthcare workers are saying, I know I'm coming to work during a pandemic. What we should all be doing as healthcare workers is sitting down, okay, let's look at this carefully. Mm-hmm. How do we do this? How do we make it safe? And so I think the first thing about this is that the majority of healthcare workers said, essentially, clearly without really good information about how they're going to be protected, said, I'm going to come to work. And that is a marker of healthcare workers are an extraordinarily dedicated group of people, and it's, I think, a reaction of the kind of contribution we saw during SARS, where healthcare workers say, this is my job, I know it's important, I'm going to be needed. That's a great thing, and it's a wonderful resource we have. But it's also important to recognize sometimes that results in people being heroes, in perhaps doing things that could be done more safely, and in not mm-hmm. looking as carefully as we should be about what's safe. So it's good that there are a minority of people who are saying, wait a minute, I'm worried about this. You know, I need to know more about this. I need to understand this. I need to be confident about it. And that was one of the important second messages about this survey, that healthcare workers very clearly said that they would be more confident about coming to work if they knew more about what the planning was. And that's it's something that anybody who does pandemic planning knows about, and a real message about how important it is to work on that section of it, that everybody who comes to work in the hospital I work in the clinics that we work in, knows what plans are in place, has had a chance to think about them and agree that those are good plans and provide as much safety as possible, understands what their role is in all of that, and is making an educated decision about work.
How would people who are coming to work be protected? What are some of the avenues that are in place now or to be in place to be able to provide that level of confidence to people so that if they are being exposed to the virus, at least they are aware that they are protected sufficiently enough to have to feel comfortable to go to work?
Well, there are a number of different ways of doing it. The first way, of course, what is most important always with influenza is vaccine. And from that perspective, we've actually done a brilliant job in Canada. There's a group of people at what is now the Public Health Agency of Canada, what was Health Canada, have spent a long time working on making sure that we have vaccine manufacturing capacity in Canada, making sure that we have a contract for pandemic vaccine manufacture, putting all the pieces in place that say that when we know what vaccine we have to make, we can make it as quickly, as efficiently mm-hmm. as possible. Still a lot of work to go on that.
Right.
But people have done an enormous amount of work, and that piece we've done really well on. Haven't necessarily communicated every healthcare worker, mm-hmm. but it's the first important piece. Now, having said that, we all know that making a vaccine takes time. And it's probable that at the beginning of the pandemic, we're not going to have an effective vaccine. And so then the next piece of it is about basically two approaches. One is drugs called antivirals. Many people have heard now about Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other new ones that are coming that will, when you take them, as prevention. So you can take them as treatment when you are infant, and they will make it less likely that you'll get seriously ill from INSA. You can take them as prevention. As long as you're taking one a day, you will be protected at least to some degree from influenza. So that's one approach. And the second approach is about thinking your way through, well, okay, if we have to have people in close contact with people with influenza, which you have to do, of course, when you're providing health care, how do we get systems in place that minimize that protection? And that starts with how we design our buildings and how we design the clinics where we're going to take care of them so that people are far enough apart from each other and the ventilation is adequate and we're keeping in as much clean air as we can. It's about understanding how we identify as influenza and who doesn't, so that people are not unexpectedly exposed to people with influenza. It's about planning our care so that patients get enough care, but healthcare workers the least amount of exposure to the secretions that are infectious from patients. And it's about what kind of barriers healthcare workers wear when they have to be in close contact with patients, the masks, gowns, gloves, that careful hand washing you have to do to protect yourself. It's actually a big complex thing that all healthcare institutions are spending a lot of time on now is how do we get all of these processes in place so that the risk to healthcare workers is minimal.
And my final question to you is with the planning that is in place or is ongoing, is this being effectively communicated to healthcare workers? As you mentioned, that there may be either some misunderstanding or lack of knowledge about what is actually being done, and so you may end up with people responding based on hearsay evidence or just fear because they're faced with an unknown and no one is giving them the information to allay the fears.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. One of the most important pieces about pandemic planning is the communication and feedback piece. And I think it's not as obvious in this survey as it's been in some other studies that people have done. There are still a number of healthcare workers who don't usually deal with, you know, influenza or infectious diseases who are saying, but, you know, I do osteoporosis usually, or I take care of other things, and so I'm not going to be working a pandemic because people don't need me. And when, of course, the truth is that we're going to need all healthcare workers. So at the very beginning of it, it starts with, yes, we're going to need healthcare workers, and then it's really about making sure that every worker understands what they're going to be needed for and how they can contribute. That's an enormous job, of course, of communication, because it's not just one way. It's not you saying to people, well, this is what you're going to do in a pandemic. It's us saying, okay, we're going to be in this lifeboat together. Mm-hmm. How do we keep the water out? And so it needs to be both a two-way communication process where we talk about how we're going to manage what will be a very difficult situation in there. And it has to be an ongoing process because one of the great things, actually, about pandemic planning is how quickly new knowledge is appearing, how many things we're learning quickly. But, of course, what that means is that what you learned last year about influenza is no longer everything you need to know for the pandemic. So the communication and learning piece is really important, very difficult, and not one that we're yet doing perfectly.
Well, Dr. McGeer, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to discuss not only the flu and pandemics, but the planning that goes into preventing the illnesses, or at least protecting the workers to help people who are suffering from the illnesses. And once again, I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Allison McGeer is Director of Infection Control at Mount Sinai Hospital and Professor in the Departments of Laboratory Medicine and Pathobiology and Public Health Sciences at the University of Toronto. We'll be taking a short break and be right back. You're listening to Sunday.